From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Maps are irresistible. That's why an online atlas became one of the first features available on most home computers. It's the reason the car is full of those things you can't fold up again that show the way to places you're never going to go anyway. And we're only scratching the surface of the planet. Simon Winchester has been looking into the life of William Smith, the man who made the world's first geological map.
The moment Smith produced this map, the world and his wife realized that there was a whole new way of looking at the Earth.
We'll hear Smith's story today, as well as several other accounts of map-making, from India to California. Also, writer and editor Peter Turchi compares the process of mapping to the work of a writer.
When we sit down to write something, we think we need to tell the reader everything. But in fact, every story is selective, and there will always be crucial omissions.
But first, a trip to the West Coast. We're starting there because, well, so many things in America seem to. Writer Eric Davis is a fifth-generation Californian who makes his home in San Francisco. Davis thinks his state provides a haven for visionaries of all kinds. He undertook a personal pilgrimage to visit the sites of California's astonishingly diverse religious visionaries. The result is a book called The Visionary State, a journey through California's spiritual landscape. Americans are so used to thinking of the country stretching from sea to shining sea that we forget California had a long history before the U.S. ever came along.
When America took it over, it was already a kind of Christian ruin with the missionary system in crumbles. And ever since then, it has played this remarkable role in the American imagination, a site of transformation, of transcendence, of natural splendor with Yosemite and the redwood trees. And it's sort of a place where America imagines itself at the edge of its own physical expanse.
It is one of the things about California that I think we can all agree on. There is, what did they used to say? It's a state of mind.
I think it is a state of mind, you know, and many, many states of mind. I mean, that's the visionary state is one way into that deeper mystery. It's a place that is made by visions, by dreams, in crass and commercial ways, as well as sublime and subtle ways. I mean, that's what Hollywood is. It's a dream factory. That's, in some ways, what the internet revolution is about, is a way of organizing the states of mind into a technology of communication and perception.
But the thing about California as a visionary state is that, in many people's minds anyway, it is a kind of altered state of consciousness, and frankly, for some, flake central.
No, absolutely. I mean, I write about in my introduction, even when I was a kid growing up, I knew that California was different, that it was the land of fruits and nuts, and we'd hear the jokes, and, you know, it was Jerry Brown was the governor, and we had this sort of moonbeam governor who was practicing Zen. And one of the reasons behind doing the visionary state and really going into the history and depth and complexity of the religious and spiritual traditions here was to kind of show that beneath that flakiness is a really fascinating, deep, complex, and profoundly influential story. To my mind, one of the great stories in American religion.
Well, one of the fascinating things about it is that there are literally dozens of religious movements.
Yes, it's a tremendously diverse environment, and that's one of the hallmarks of the whole tradition, if you will, that I'm trying to capture in the book, is its tremendous diversity. There's a lot of room in the state for people to pursue their own paths, to invent new paths, to transplant religions from other parts of the planet. And this has created this incredibly rich landscape, this sort of psychogeography of various ways to approach the divine. And I did actually visit almost every place that I write about in the book. That became a sort of personal side of the whole project for me, was turning it into a kind of pilgrimage as well as an intellectual and historical research. It really was a way to re-enchant my state and to understand and to experience, really, the different ways that people have used architecture and sacred spaces to implant these multiple visions of the divine.
Well, to get an understanding of this, we ought to talk about some of the specifics. You start with shamanism and the effect of it on, you call them geoglyphs and painted rocks?
Yeah, we started off, you know, partly, if you're going to talk about the sacred history of a place, you have to talk about its original inhabitants. And like many parts of the world, California has a glorious tradition of rock art. which, you know, though we don't really know exactly what it means, seems to indicate that it has some kind of sacred overtones. And by showing some of the remarkable rock art sites in California, which include petroglyphs and pictographs and these geoglyphs, which are these large figures that you can really only glimpse from the air. They're very peculiar, kind of odd figures. We're also sort of saying something about the way that landscape and geography help shape the sacred imagination, which is one of the founding themes of the book, that you can understand a spirituality or religion by visiting the places, by understanding how people inhabited places through architecture or through recognizing certain aspects of the landscape. So it's a really appropriate way to begin the whole story.
You know, I think if you were to ask people for an immediate image that comes to mind when you talk about California and spirituality, it might very well be those missions that were built by the Spaniards, the Christian missions with their adobe walls and the mission bells, even though I'm not sure anybody worships there anymore. Where did they come from? Was it just the Spaniards?
Yeah, when you grow up in California, the missions are the sort of first stop on your, you know, historical imagination of the place. And they continue to function today. Actually, Catholic services are held in most, if not all, of the missions. And they were the way that Spain originally attempted to kind of colonize the place, to claim the land, was by creating this series of missions. But again, by the middle of the 19th century, when the Anglo-Americans showed up, the mission system was basically in ruins, literally. The power structure was disintegrated. The Indians were kind of destroyed already in many ways by the imposition of this system. And it wasn't until the late 19th century that Americans started to go, wow, these ruins are kind of romantic. They're kind of nifty. What's going on there? And so the missions became a way for Anglo-Americans to kind of create their own ancestors, to create their own sense of the past, the way that Greek ruins functioned in the German imagination. The missions ended up functioning in the Yankee imagination. And in fact, they all became reconstructed. So the missions that you visit now are as much theme parks as they are, you know, authentic connections to this Spanish missionary past. A lot of the elements in them, the Moorish fountains, etc., are 20th century creations. So it's a very peculiar mixture of theme park and tradition that kind of founds this fundamental religious imagination of California.
There is a theme running through many of the places that you visit that is this storyline that goes on top of the original heartfelt creation of a spiritual order. You talk in the book about how what we know best about the missions may in fact be a work of fiction, right?
Yeah, that they're sites of imagination as much as they are of kind of living continuity. But that's in many ways what happens in a place like California, a rootless place, is that you need to invent your traditions. And that invention can be kind of a bit of a lie, a bit of a delusion, but it can also be a creative act. And indeed, many of the ways that people that I describe in the book have created their own traditions is really a sign of the intense creativity of the religious imagination, as well as its ability to sometimes fool itself.
The other piece about California that makes it unnatural is the natural beauty of California. Yosemite, for instance, you call a spiritual moment, but you go on and you call John Muir the first great Californian pagan?
In many ways, I do. I think that's accurate. He had an incredible Dionysian spirit, and some of his most exuberant writings are really, you know, passionately pantheist. And while he was motivated in some ways by some core Christian themes, he really left the whole sort of kit and caboodle of sin and redemption and transcendence behind him and really embraced a physical universe, but he embraced this physical universe in a deeply sacred and spiritual way that really kind of founded this sense of a natural mysticism that went on to influence many things in the 20th century, not just paganism or nature mysticism in the New Age, but also environmentalism. And the kind of passion that even today people bring to the topic of environmentalism is infused with a kind of paganism or paganism light that you can trace back to a figure like John Muir.
Of course, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, he's from Calvinist stock in Scotland, came through Wisconsin. We'd like to make our own claim on him on his way to California. But then you go to Muir Woods, and there isn't any question, really, that that is a spiritual place.
Absolutely. I mean, the power of nature in California, even today after all the strip malls and ravagement, is really quite extraordinary, not just in terms of the power of the redwood trees or of a landscape like Yosemite, but in its diversity alone, the range of ecosystems that are kind of all put together in this admittedly rather large state is really quite extraordinary. So it's not just the fact that nature is big and beautiful here, but its diversity is also incredibly informing in terms of the cultures that emerge here. And this was true even in Native American times when the landscape held a tremendous diversity of languages. There's over 100 languages that people spoke inside California. There's something about the place that calls for diversity and transformation.
Eric Davis is a writer, independent scholar, and culture critic. His book is called The Visionary State, A Journey Through California's Spiritual Landscape, and features photographs by Michael Rauner. You can see some of them on our website. Come visit us at ttbook.org. Peter Turchi is the author of a novel and a collection of short stories, and he's co-edited volumes of short fiction with Charles Baxter and Andrea Barrett. Turchi directs the MFA program for writers at Warren Wilson College in Asheville, North Carolina. His students can take the title of his most recent book as an object lesson in how to pique a reader's interest. The book is called Maps of the Imagination, The Writer as Cartographer. That title, and a really clever cover with a drawing of a human head superimposed on a map grid, was enough to get Steve Paulson talking to Peter Turchi.
What is the connection between writing and maps?
Well, a lot of people talk about, and readers often talk about, being lost in the world of a story or a novel. And they don't talk about it the way you talk about being lost in the mall or lost downtown, you know, trying to find a parking space. There's something delightful about being lost in a story or a novel. And there's a sense that you're in some world. You've been taken someplace you want to stay, and you're happy to have been transported in that way. And so I started to think about whether that means that we're following a map, or a writer's job is to make a map that leads a reader somewhere, or how it is that when you read, you have that experience of being taken to some new place.
So you're saying, just as a map is all about exploration, it's about especially those people who actually created the maps, it's about going into the unknown and charting undiscovered territory. You're saying that's really what writing is all about, and I suppose in some ways reading as well.
Well, the writer's job is in part a matter of exploration. You have an idea, or you think of a situation and characters, and you explore it and try to figure it out. And then your job is to create a path or a chart for the reader. And of course, part of the fun of writing is that you're not necessarily trying to tell a reader exactly where to go and what to do. You're trying to create an experience for the reader.
Hmm. Well, there's an interesting question. Is the best map the most accurate map, the one with the most detail?
Oh, it certainly is not, because when you think about the map you want, the map I took, say, to get to the radio station today, I want street information. I want to know what turns to make. I don't particularly care, say, where the sewer lines run. I don't care where the bird nesting sites are. I don't care what the zoning is. There's all kinds of information I don't want on that map, because if it's there, I won't be able to find what I need to find. And so, in fact, it's what we leave off the map that defines the map. Because if we wanted to put everything on the map, we've got that in the world. You know, we've got everything there. What we're doing when we make a map is subtract information and highlight information. And of course, that's true of writing.
Yeah. Well, I think about those subway maps we see, the ones in a big city where there are all those different train lines that are outlined in bright colors. And I'm sure those are geographically not terribly accurate, in these straight lines. But they sure are effective because, you know when to get off on the right stop.
There's a wonderful lesson there for every writer, right? We think we want accuracy and we think we want detail, but there was a map, famously the tube map in London, that was so filled with information and so dense and difficult to read that people didn't know what train to get on or how to get where they were going. And so the Wayfinder, the first version of that map, reduced those lines so that they were color-coded, so that the angles, they were limited in the angles they used, 45 and 30 and 60 and 90 and 100-degree angles. And the only information on the map was the name of the stops. And they weren't necessarily even set apart on the map. You know, it'd correct distances so that one might be twice as far as another. They were set so you could read them. When you're trying to get on a subway, all you need to know is which line to get on and which stop to get off of. You don't want any other information. A lot of times when we sit down to write something, you know, especially if we're writing, say, realistic fiction, we think we need to tell the reader everything from the beginning of a character's day to the end of the day, what job he has and what irritates him about it, everything. But in fact, every story is selective, and every story has to guide us in certain ways, and there will always be crucial omissions.
Now, one point you make in your book is that all fiction lies. I mean, by its very nature, it is a lie because it's concocting imaginary worlds. And you say that that's true with maps as well. All maps lie, which is not nearly as obvious to me.
Oh, no. Well, every map, it says that it's telling the truth, of course. I mean, that's how maps operate. But there are distortions. I mean, the crucial thing is not that they actually have inaccuracies. The question is, you know, what is accuracy in a map? The most obvious example is, you know, what in geography class they'll call the orange peel problem, the problem with trying to map any spot on the Earth is that you're making something on a flat sheet of paper. And of course, the Earth is not flat. And to convey the curved surface or the irregular surface of the Earth on a piece of paper, there has to be some distortion. Famously, in the Mercator projection that most people know from maps they saw all through childhood and even now, it looks as if Greenland is the size of South America.
Right. Greenland is huge.
And I think that's important for writers to recognize because we think, okay, if we read some very experimental work, maybe, that seems distorted, that seems unlifelike. But realism is a distortion too. And maybe it's easiest to imagine this when you think about realism in the visual arts. When you think about that old exercise in perspective we all did in art class where you try to draw a building, you know, so that it recedes into the distance and you draw, say, the lines on the rooftop so that they meet in the back corner of it. Well, you know, in life, the two sides of that building don't meet. They don't touch that way, right? The road doesn't disappear into a point in real life. But what we're trying to do is to recreate what we see. And so to try to recreate our perception, we're distorting what really exists. You know, eventually that Mercator projection was so dominant in mapmaking that people just started to see the world that way. And in fact, well, another example of that is we're used to seeing the United States in the middle of maps. So when you go to Australia, say, and they hand you their, well, they actually even call it the upside down map, but a map oriented toward the south, because there's no reason for a map to be oriented north necessarily. If it's oriented to the south and Australia is in the center of the map, you say, well, you know, what's with this? Is this some kind of joke? And you say, well, you know, what kind of map is this? How could you use that?
So everyone wants to put themselves at the center or their culture, their world in the middle of things.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, that's a wonderful thing to remember about characters, too. When you're writing about, you know, any piece of fiction from a character's perspective, we all, you know, see from our point and it distorts our sense of the world. A famous example of that is that old cover of The New Yorker that showed, you know, the view of the world from 9th Avenue, I think it is, right? Saul Steinberg's image, where you see various parts of New York up close, and then you see, you know, the middle of the country all but disappears. You see California, just a little sliver off on the horizon, and then we know Europe is out there somewhere. The New Yorker's view of the world. But we all have some of that sense of the world, too. You know, what's nearest looms large.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you have pored over lots of maps from the centuries. Do you have one or two favorites you've come across?
You know, some of the maps we love are just beautiful. And one of the maps I have in the book is of the world's longest rivers and the world's tallest mountains. And it's one of the strangest maps in there because it doesn't attempt to locate those mountains and rivers, you know, in particular countries or even on particular continents. They're just shown next to each other. It's a very useful map for comparing those things. If you've ever wondered how long the Nile is compared to the Mississippi, say, this is the way to see it. If you've ever wondered, you know, how tall Kilimanjaro is compared to Mount Everest, it would be a terrible hiking map. And it, you know, reminds me that sometimes the most inventive fiction, the most experimental work we read, which seems, you know, unrealistic, sometimes its value is that it allows us to see the world in a way we had never thought of seeing it, but which turns out to be useful.
Huh. And then there are some writers who actually include maps in their stories. I mean, basically to help the readers, because there can be very convoluted plots, and especially if it's a fantasy story, you're wondering where things are. It really helps to be able to look at this and see where things are in relation to each other.
Yeah, one of my favorite examples, and there's a reproduction of it in the book, is Robert Louis Stevenson's Map of Treasure Island. That was the first real book I read. The first adult book I read was Treasure Island, and I remember being captivated by the map, of course. The notion of treasure maps is pretty fascinating, and people's obsession with those. But the wonderful thing about that story is that Stevenson was just out drawing. He drew the map, and he was so enchanted by the map that he started to tell a story about it. He ended up writing what we know as Treasure Island. He sent it off to his publisher. But when he did, the map got lost. And when he told the publisher, he said, there was supposed to be a map with this when they printed it. When they had the galleys, they said they hadn't gotten it, and he had to recreate it. And he said it was the most painful thing to have to go back through the manuscript and to figure out where everything belonged and, where it had to be for certain things to make sense. So he said the map that appears in the book, the map we all know as the map of Treasure Island, is not Treasure Island to him.
That's a great story. and obviously that really mattered to him. I mean, some people would think, who cares if there's a map that accompanies the story? But for him, it really was important.
Oh, well, and it speaks in a metaphorical way, too, of course, because a writer always has a notion of his story or his novel or, or poem. We always have a sense of the work, and then readers get the work, and they bring their own, background and understanding to it. And so they say, I love that book. I especially love the way you emphasized whatever. And we'll say, I hadn't really thought about it that way. That's not what I had in mind. But after a point, the book or the story exists out in the world, and it is completed by the reader's experience. So even if Stevenson had the original map of Treasure Island in the book, at some point, the book that he sent out into the world was going to be interpreted by other people differently, seen by other people differently.
Peter Turchi is the author of Maps of the Imagination, the writer as cartographer. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Trinidad and the Big Mississippi and the town Honolulu and the Lake Titicaca. The Popocatepetl is not in Canada, rather in Mexico.
Trinidad!
Imagine making a map not of what's on the Earth, but what's underneath it.
The astonishing thing to me is that it's all such a recent story, and that the figures that were involved in the early days of the story present such an extraordinary human drama.
That's Simon Winchester. He'll tell us the story of the world's first geological map a little later. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Imagine being born into the teeming chaos of the Indian subcontinent, and then, to make matters worse, try immigrating to New York City. That's what novelist Chitra Banerjee Divakaruni did, and she's managed to turn out several first-rate novels along the way. Now she's turned her attention to literature for children, partly because she's a mom herself. But as she told Anstrange Shams, Chitra Divakaruni had another reason for writing a book called The Conchbearer.
9/11 had just occurred, and it really struck me, particularly because of the hate crimes that followed 9/11, that it was very important. This was a very important time in America to really create a multicultural literature for children. And I really wanted to give something to children growing up here, which would be Indian and which would come from an Indian background. As I looked at books that were available, there were many wonderful ones, but not many that were based in India, not many that were by Indian authors.
What sort of Indian elements did you deliberately want to fold into the books?
Well, they are magical adventures, so I went back to the fairy tales and folk tales that I had grown up with to look at what were some mythic elements that I could bring in. And in The Conch Bearer, for example, the conch, it's a very old and sacred element. It's an object that's mentioned in many of our ancient myths and epics. So I wanted to bring that in. And I wanted to bring in the land. So in The Conch Bearer, as Anand, Nisha, and Abhaydatta journey across India to return the magical conch to its home, we see the daily life of the people.
There's another magical element you folded in. I'm thinking about the Silver Valley, this magical place your characters are heading towards. Isn't that a version of the myth of Shangri-La?
Absolutely. And that is a big part of, you know, Indian myth. Even now, people talk about these hidden valleys in the Himalayas. If only we could just get to them, everything would be perfect. And when I was younger, I did a fair amount of traveling in the mountains. So I think that myth has a special interest for me, and my own experience in the mountains, all of that got folded into the Conch Bearer.
And I think the wonderful thing about books like this, books that have magic in them, is that they let us live for a little while in a world in which magic is real. You know, your adult novels also contain some of those magical elements. So I'm wondering where that fascination with magic and mysticism, where that comes from for you.
I guess that's something very deep in me. It's been an interest of mine for a long time. And also as a meditator and a person who tries to follow a spiritual path, I do believe that this world that we're seeing, we don't see it in its true aspect. And its true aspect is much more magical and much more beautiful and much more magnetic than what it is that we see around us. So I'm always trying to uncover these mysterious facets of the world that we live in.
Have you been able to explore that magical aspect of the world? You also called it the true nature of the world. Have you encountered it yourself in your own waking daily life, or is it something you encounter mostly in your writing?
Well, I think I have encountered it. I mean, I could start telling you stories and there wouldn't be time for that, but every once in a while, amazing things will happen. And, you know I'm not alone in this because other people have written about it and they've talked about it, and some call it synchronicity and others call it by other names. But things happen. There are large and mysterious patterns of which we become aware from time to time.
What's the most magical or mysterious thing that's ever happened
to you?
You
want a little story?
Yes.
Okay, this was when I was up in the Himalayas and I had gone there for a pilgrimage. And we had to go to a place called Amarnath. To get there, you have to climb for about 4 days across glaciers. And the only way to do is to walk. And then it takes 2 days to come down. And when we were coming down, then it started raining very heavily, which is really bad, as you can imagine, when you're on glaciers, because the paths wash away, you know, big holes open up. And also, the ground is like slush. So here I was trying to walk through this slush, and I was really tired. And I got separated from my group, and, you know, they went on ahead. People just go on ahead. These are loosely formed groups of pilgrims. We don't necessarily know each other from before. But we just walk from, like, one rest stop to the other rest stop together. So I got separated, and it was getting to be evening. And I came to a part in the road where the road was completely washed away. And instead, now there was a river. And, you know, the only way to get across would be if I could jump across that river. And I just did not have it in me to jump across anything at that point. So I just sat down there, and I was sure that I was going to die because, you know, if I was outside on the mountain at night, I would just freeze to death. And so it's getting closer. And then this old man comes from behind me. And I hadn't really seen him before, but then, you know, I didn't know all the pilgrims. And he says, and he has this long stick. And he says, "Don't worry, I'm going to jump across, and then I'm going to give you the stick, and then you just hold on to it, and I'll pull you across." So at that point, I had no option. So I said, "Fine." So he jumped across, and he gave me the stick, and he pulled me across. He was very strong. He looked like he was in his 70s. He was white-haired with a beard. And he said, "Come, I know this the way back to the next rest stop, so you can walk with me." So I walked with him. And then he said, "Well, I have to go on because my camp is just beyond the mountain." And so I went to my rest area. And then he went off. In the morning, when I thought about it, I thought I really need to go and thank him because he really saved my life. So before our group started going down further on its way, I went across to the other side of this little peak. On one side was our rest camp, and on the other side, according to him, was his rest camp. And there was nothing. Hmm. There was nobody over there. Hmm. So, you know, what do you make of that? I think he was one of the spirits of the mountain. That's what I think. And those are the kinds of people that I've tried to weave into my books, hopefully in a way where other readers can, you know, relate to them and appreciate that we do indeed live in a magical world.
Chitra Devakaruni is the author of The Conchbearer and its sequel, The Mirror of Fire and Dreaming. Anne Strangeham spoke with her.
Follow the yellow brick road. Follow the yellow brick road.
Got a magical story to share? Been down a path that doesn't show up on any maps? We'd love to hear about it. You can send us an email through our website at ttbook.org. Simon Winchester hit the jackpot with his book about the man behind the Oxford English Dictionary. So, naturally, his publisher asked him to look for another obscure, eccentric academic whose life could be spun into a best-selling page-turner. Winchester contacted one of his old professors for help, and the result is a book called The Map That Changed the World, William Smith and the Birth of Modern Geology. Simon Winchester read a bit from the book's opening.
Above one of the many grand marble staircases within the east wing of Burlington House hangs a pair of huge sky-blue velvet curtains. Although many may wonder in passing, rarely does any one of the scores of people who climb and descend the stairs inquire as to what lies behind the drapes. Once in a while, someone curious and bold will demand a look, whereupon a functionary will emerge from behind a door marked private, and with practiced hand will tug gently on the silk ropes. The curtains will slowly part, revealing an enormous and magnificent map of England and Wales, engraved and coloured in sea blue, green, bright yellow, orange, umber, in a beguiling and unfamiliar mixture of lines, patches, and stippled shapes. The document is exquisitely beautiful, a beauty set off by its great size, more than 8 feet by 6, and by the fact that it towers, looms indeed, above those who stand on the staircase to see it. The care and attention to its detail is clear. This is the work of a craftsman, lovingly done, the culmination of years of study, months of careful labour. This, the official will explain, is the first true geological map of anywhere in the world.
Simon Winchester could probably make anybody's life sound fascinating, but William Smith actually gave him quite a bit to work with, even if his name and circumstances seem quite ordinary.
He couldn't have been more ordinary. I mean, how more ordinary a name could you get than Bill Smith? He was the orphaned son of a blacksmith. He went off to live with his aunt and uncle on a farm in western Oxfordshire. Because the aunt ran a dairy, and because she weighed out pounds of butter using a stone, and because this stone looked like a sea urchin to young William Smith, he became enraptured by this stone, this weight, fascinated by how it might have been created, fascinated by fossils, and fascinated by the earth under his feet. He was ill-educated, but he managed to get a job helping to dig a canal just to the south of the city of Bath. And he had this epiphany, a true moment of genius, something that sounds perfectly obvious to us today, which is that rocks are arranged in layers. The rocks at the top of a series of horizontal layers are, he said, more recently laid down than the rocks at the bottom. That was an early epiphany. Moreover, certain rocks can be identified by the fossils that occur within them. That was a second realization, perfectly obvious to us today. But in the 18th century, when people believed that fossils had nothing to do with life at all, that they were simply objects that had been placed in the rocks by God to show everyone what a wonderfully clever chap God was, that also was a revelation. And they were two revelations that enabled Smith suddenly to realize he could do something that had never, ever been done before. He could draw a map. If he had enough information about the way that rocks dipped down below the surface of the earth and what those rocks were, he could do the unimaginable. He could draw a map of the unseen, the invisible underneath of the countryside.
The map is the essence of the story, and we really must talk about it, but I think that you do need to firmly set the scene. This was a time in our history when we did not yet know of Darwin's theory. We did not yet believe that there was any past other than that written in the good book.
According to the people that were alive and kicking when William Smith was growing up as a boy, the world was created at a precise moment, 9 o'clock on the morning of Monday, the 25th of October, 4004 BC. That date, sounds ludicrous to us today, had been calculated with great precision by this priest in Armagh in Ireland called James Usher. And everyone believed it. I mean, it took 7 days to create, so by the 1st of November, 4004 BC, God rested. Fossils were nothing to do with life. Yeah. They were, as I mentioned, simply put there to show how clever God was. This fog of ignorance and dogmatic belief from the Bible had to be pierced by someone, and it was Smith's work that began pushing this fog out of the way and allow us to realize that the Earth is a great deal older, thousands, millions of years older, that there had been sea in places where there is now land, that fossils had been things that were alive in the sea that had died and had drifted down to the bottom. These perfectly simple things, which we take as holy writ today, were in fact utter heresy as recently as 200 years ago.
So was it in fact heresy for Smith to have these two epiphanies and to notice the stratification and the placement of the fossils and the relationship of them?
Because he was so lowly born, the church didn't take it seriously. The people who did take it seriously were the people that ran geology at the time and who believed in Noah's flood and who were engaged in a debate between the Neptunists on the one hand, that believed all rocks had precipitated from the sea, and the Plutonists on the other, who believed everything had been vomited out of volcanoes. So they weren't concerned. There was no argument. Of course it had all begun on the 25th of October, 4004 BC. Geology didn't dispute that till Smith came along, but he was sufficiently lowly born that no one took him seriously at first, except these aristocrats that ran geology saw that this man had had the impertinence to create a map, thought it was a remarkably good map, and decided to copy it themselves, plagiarize it, sell it at a lower price than his was priced at, drive him into penury, bankruptcy, and the debtor's prison. So he was then out of circulation. The church didn't care about him too much. But serious science slowly took his ideas on board. And by the time he returned to London, because of the fairy tale ending of this story, returned in some sort of triumph, science had suddenly embraced this and was in a head-on collision with the church, a head-on collision that, of course, reached its most dramatic when, in 1859, Darwin wrote and published The Origin of Species. Yeah. Then geology and theology collided head-on.
Back to William Smith at a moment. It wasn't simply this matter of epiphany as he looked at the strata in the sides of the canal that he was digging or as he looked at fossils. What was it that spurred him to the realization that he could create a map, and how did he accomplish that as one man?
It's quite extraordinary. He, first of all, once he realized he could draw a map, he drew a small one of the area around Bath that he knew, putting 6 layers of rocks onto it. It's very primitive. The original still exists. In 1801, just over 2 centuries ago, he had a stab at the whole country. On a tiny little sort of 6-inch by 9-inch map of Britain, he drew from what few observations he had an idea of roughly where the outcrop of the Jurassic, which is the rock that produces most of the loveliest building stone of the Cotswolds. If you've ever seen little thatched cottages with honey-coloured stone, that's Jurassic, Middle Jurassic limestone. But then he realized he was on to something. He realized the only way he could produce a real map was to leave his job as a canal digger and start tramping across England by foot or on stagecoach or in any manner he could to get as much information as he possibly could acquire. And it took him 15 long years of hobnail boots and walking sticks and rain gear and sitting up alongside the driver on stagecoach journeys, earning a little money, you know, cash as catch can, to keep this obsession going. But he was utterly obsessed because he knew if he picked up enough information, he could draw a map. And in the end, after 15 years on his own, working hard, going everywhere from Cornwall to Northumberland, from Dover to Glasgow, he made this map.
It's an astonishing story. And then you come to the other stratification, the stratification of English society that allowed him to make these observations without incurring the wrath of the church, but then also forced him to deal with people who would steal from him without blinking an eye.
That was the extraordinary thing. The people that ran geology were perfumed dandies, aristocrats who looked at fossils for their aesthetic value than for any other purpose, really, and regarded the publication of a map by a man who couldn't comport himself in society, who had a bad accent, who didn't have connections, they thought of this as absolute impertinence. So they did him down. They copied it, sold it at a lower price. He went bankrupt. He went into debtor's prison. Everything he owned had to be sold off, including his huge geological collection. And he had to leave London with his wife, who also was going mad, as it happened, and became, to his presumed exhaustion, a nymphomaniac. And the two of them left London and for the next decade were living homeless in Yorkshire and Westmoreland and Cumberland. A terrible, terrible time until, in the end, mercifully, and perhaps it's not proper to give away the fairy tale ending of this tale, he was discovered and it was realised who he was, and the honour that should have come to him was eventually given to him, but after a lot of suffering.
You describe this as the map that changed the world, the title of your book. Is it still a map on which you can rely? Is the information in that map something that a geologist today would look at and recognize immediately?
In a heartbeat. I mean, William Smith not only produced something that was beautiful, not only did it on his own, but he got it right. In fine detail, of course, no, the map can't be relied upon. It's old and relatively non-accurate. But in its broad brush, and considering it was done by one man, to get it as right as he did is an astonishing achievement.
And what he did in creating that map was to change the way in which the world was perceived. And that, of course, then would have enormous impact on the economy of the world, the way in which industry approached the world beneath us.
Well, it meant that all of a sudden, someone sitting in Kansas or central Germany, who might wonder idly, what on earth is beneath my feet? You get a geological map and you know exactly what's beneath your feet. You might know when you're sitting in Kansas in, let's say, 1890, that 5,000 feet below your feet is oil. And you would know that because a geological map showed you that that's where the places where oil gathers is likely to be. The moment Smith produced this map, the world and his wife realized that there was a whole new way of looking at the Earth, and that suddenly a nation that was sitting on natural resources knew where they could be found, knew where they could exploit the Earth to get out the treasures that lie within it.
Simon Winchester is the author of many books, including The Map That Changed the World, William Smith, and The Birth of Modern Geology. Coming up, Madar Jaffrey recalls the tastes of home, chutney, green chilies, and mangoes.
To eat something is to know about a whole area of the world.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. India is home to some of the world's great cuisines, from tandoori chicken to tangy tamarind chutney, thick curries to crisp samosas. Indian food is intoxicating, and no one has written about it with more authority than food writer and actress Madar Jaffrey. She talked recently with Anne Strainchamps about her memoir. It's called Climbing the Mango Trees. And like any good storyteller, Madar Jaffrey begins at the beginning.
The book actually starts with what I call my first memory. When anyone is born in our particular family, we were all born at home, and my grandmother would come. She'd amble in with a jar of honey, and then she'd dip her little finger in honey and write on our little new tongues, Om, which means I am. And my mother always tells the story that when it was done to me, I licked it up and then opened my mouth for more. So this honey has been a part of my existence since I existed.
What a wonderful way for a new baby to be welcomed. Now, you had a really big family, right? I mean, I think you write that you could have easily had 40 people sitting down for a family meal.
Well, I didn't know that things happened in different ways in parts of the world. I just assumed this was a natural family.
So when this whole big family got together for meals, who cooked for all those people?
There was a whole annex for dining. And in this, there was a huge dining room. On one side, it faced the river. So it was really, the views were wonderful. And first, there was one long dining table with my grandfather sitting at the head. And as children came, tables were added. So by the time I came, there were three long tables.
It sounds more like a family hotel than a family house.
Well, it sort of was, and it sort of wasn't, because it was all very casual. And my grandfather sat at the head of the table with my grandmother next to him. And I have to tell you that I didn't know till I was grown up that my grandmother was a vegetarian. I couldn't see what she was eating. She was at the other end. I could see my grandfather and his white beard sort of bobbing, and he used to drink club soda. So that I knew. And then you see, next to the big dining room was an area where there was storage and we washed our hands. Then there was a huge storage room with all the pickling jars and all the big drums of rice and beans and, you know, things like that. And then there was a huge kitchen. And the kitchen was divided into two sections. There was one little section where game was cooked, like my father and my brothers and cousins would go hunting. And they might be cooking a whole leg of wild boar. There was a special section for that. And then there was the regular part of the kitchen where daily meals were cooked. And there was a cook with his assistants who did the cooking. But if it was a special occasion, like a festival, then my grandmother and all the ladies of the house would go in and start rolling out breads or special poppadom-like things and make special things for picnics or festivals or things like that.
Mm. The title of your book is Climbing the Mango Trees. And you really did climb mango trees, right? Didn't your family have an orchard?
Yes, my grandfather used to live in the old city, which was the old walled city, a medieval city. Well, not quite medieval. It was built in the 17th century. This was the Mughal Delhi, built by the Mughal emperors who were there from the 16th century to the 19th century. So the family lived there.
Even growing up in Delhi, am I right that mangoes were still a special fruit, not just something ordinary?
Well, in a way, all fruits were special because they came in their seasons. And you had to wait for them. And mangoes came once a year in the summer. But apart from that, we did consider them the king of fruit because we loved mangoes. Absolutely, everyone loved them. And everybody had their favorites. And mangoes in India are not just mangoes. They're different varieties. Like you have cheeses in America, different cheeses. You don't go to the shop and say, give me cheese. And we don't go to a shop and say, give me mangoes. We'll ask for the variety that we like. Some are more sour, some are sweet and sour. They all have their own flavors. You ask for your particular flavor.
How many different kinds of mangoes are there?
I would say there were hundreds.
Really?
I would say it's like cheeses. Every area has its own specialties. And then generally speaking, there are mangoes that travel throughout India that are considered absolutely scrumptious. And one of those would be the Alfonso, which has the texture of the softest of peaches. And it's very, very sweet and luscious. It has a satiny texture. And that is the mango that might come to America. And somehow, weirdly enough, it's tied up to the nuclear treaty with India. And if the nuclear
mango?
Treaty...
Mango? Wait.
Yes,
importation is linked to nuclear treaties?
I actually wrote a piece about it in the New York Times that I wish the treaty goes through because we'll get mangoes as a result of it. It's one of the little clauses stuck at the bottom of this treaty that somehow then we'll have a trade and Indian mangoes will be allowed into America.
I think somebody negotiating that treaty really likes mangoes.
Really, somebody was very smart and say, okay, this is a little bit of pork for us. Let's get it in there.
Well, I feel very cheated as an American cook that I've only ever tasted one kind of mango.
Well, you know, there's a world waiting for you. And once the import of mangoes is allowed, you just see what you'll get. It's night and day. The quality of the Indian mango without any fiber. You see, what had happened with the mango, the history of the mango in America is such that it came in the 18th century. 19th century, did come into Florida. But then they slowly bred the fiber into it because they wanted long shelf life.
Then it would travel better.
So they killed the mango. And in India, it took only 2,000 years to breed the fiber out. So now we have this perfect mango that we've taken 2,000 years to make into a perfect mango. And within half a century, America destroyed it. For America, we still have it in India.
Well, I hate to say, but America's done that with a great many things.
where food is concerned, we are going backwards. We are really. America is now trying to take the right step. So we can't condemn what's happening. I think people are trying to grow the right mango. And if we just let the process happen and let it be exported to the rest of the country, Florida still has some good mangoes, but they can't go out because they're competing with Mexican mangoes or whatever. It's a long story unto itself, but I think we are in dire need of good mangoes in this country.
This makes me think of the apple because, you know, we've in the last decade or so come to really appreciate our American heirloom apples, and we've
Absolutely.
Come to pay so much more attention so that now...
Our tomatoes, our apples, our corn. I got some special seed from Alice Waters, and that is the corn I grow because it's unhybridized corn, and it's wonderful.
Well, I was wondering, here in the U.S., the apple is a fruit with a great mythology, a great folklore behind it. I mean, school children learn the story of Johnny Appleseed, for instance. Is that true of mangoes in India? Is there a kind of mango folklore?
There are 100 stories, absolutely. Lord Buddha, who lived around 5,000 B.C., used to sit under the shade of a mango tree. The mango leaf is used at every wedding, Hindu wedding in India. It's considered very auspicious. There are 100 stories tied to the mango and the mango tree.
Do you have a favorite mango recipe or recipe that uses mangoes?
If it's a good mango, you need to do nothing to it. You just need to put it in a bucket of icy water, let it cool, peel it, and eat it. If it's a good mango, it's with bad mangoes that you do things. And it's with the green mango. The other aspect of the mango that people don't know is that the green mango is sour and it has a lot of pectin. So that is why all the chutneys have some green mango in them, because it forms the gelatin-like base to any preserved chutney. There are all kinds of chutneys in India, but if you want the preserved type of chutney, for the preserving element, it's the pectin that's necessary, and the green mango is just full of it. And it's also sour, so it balances well with sugar. So it provides and makes for the perfect chutney.
Madhur Jaffrey is an actress and the Julia Child of India. Her memoir is called Climbing the Mango Trees, and Strange Gems talked with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want to hear this program again, check an author's name or find out about a piece of music we used, visit our website. It's www.ttbook.org. To buy a copy of the program, just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 123B, Mapping the Imagination. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Mary Lou Finnegan, with help from Ann Strange Shemps, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.